Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or item read on Airs LA or the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 241 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs and commentaries from gardeners and designers, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I've spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, and space. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. Our first article this week was published on March 29th in the Wall Street Journal. It's by Michelle Slatala, Seven Lessons to Learn from My Gardening Blunders. Our columnist, who once helmed a website dedicated to gardening, shares the seven worst mistakes she's made in her own plot and their fixes. The worst gardening mistake I ever witnessed was unfortunately one I made. After my husband and I bought our first house on Long Island, New York, we decided to lay sod. Yes, by ourselves, because how hard could it be in our tiny backyard? We spent a weekend rototilling, raking, and carefully arranging velvety green squares of grass on top of fluffed-up soil. We even rented a big lawn roller to iron out air pockets. But 2 weeks later, the sod had died and shriveled up, exposing stripes of dirt in between the lozenges of brown turf. "Should we just sell the house?" my husband asked, surveying the horrific results of the misguided DIY project. "Probably, but who would buy it in this condition?" I said. So, instead, we started over, hiring a professional installer who explained that we should have tested and amended the heavy clay soil with sand before laying sod. We were able to learn a lesson and continue to live in the house. But honestly, I would rather have avoided the mistake and the nightmares I had for years in which I was being chased by a giant sod roller and leapt straight to the lesson. So with a new gardening season upon us, I think the least I can do is help you avoid other mistakes I've made. Here are seven of them with rectifying tips from experts. 1. Tree timidity. A garden tree is a big deal. It's a major focal point and, oh, by the way, a feature meant to outlive the person who plants it. So it's no wonder the idea of cutting off any of my olive tree's baby branches was intimidating. But after 10 years of being ignored, the tree had lost its architectural open-cup shape and looked like a frazzled lollipop. The cure? Shape it confidently because trees are resilient, said Lou Meyer, a Davy Tree Expert Company arborist in Baltimore, who qualifies his encouragement with a warning not to cut off more than 25% of their branches in 1 year. He recommends a pruning saw to remove dead wood, any branches that cross or rub against each other, and vertical branches that sprout up like errant hairs. Remove those subordinate branches where they meet the parent branch, cutting them off where you can see a little ridge called the collar, Meyer said. Leave the collar, which contains chemicals to help the tree heal. 2. Inferior decor. It feels like I have spent $1 billion on outdoor furnishings that faded, rotted, or got moldy after a season or two. And when I got rid of them, I contributed to the 12 million tons of disposable furniture that Americans send to landfills every year. The cure? Bypass cheap throwaway pieces in favor of those made of materials like teak and powder-coated aluminum, which should withstand the elements for a decade, said Tony Peng, managing director of Oasic, an outdoor furniture company in Brooklyn. His tip for more vulnerable soft furnishings like cushions and rugs? Buy materials labeled water-repellent, not waterproof, which can trap moisture and humidity beneath their surface and lead to mildew. 3. Friendless flora. How often have I been seduced by some amazing plant in bloom, only to buy one, bring it home, stick it into a prominent spot in the garden, and realize a month later, after it stops blooming, that it looks out of place and lonely. Over time, I also noticed that buying so many one-and-done plants had turned the garden into a mishmash. That's because when you have a lot of competing individual plants and every one of them is saying, "Look at me," nothing has visual impact anymore, said Liz Pulver, a Brooklyn landscape architect. The cure? Buy at least 3 of any plant. When you have 3 together, the mass serves as a backdrop or a contrast for other plants, Pulver said. Masses create patterns that are pleasing to look at. 4. Limited engagement. My garden used to look amazing in June when the roses are blooming, and the rest of the year kind of blah. The cure? Flowering annuals like salvias combat the doldrums of July and August, and evergreens and plants with colorful bark, think red twig dogwoods, add color and texture even in winter. If you live in New Hampshire, where there's snow on the ground 6 months of the year, think about the joy you'll get from a holly tree with bright red berries in darkest winter, said Edmund Hollander, a Manhattan landscape architect and author of The Landscape of Home, Rizzoli 2024. Or if you live in Atlanta, think of the magic of light dancing on the foliage of dogwoods in the early spring. 5. Water worries. If you rely on irrigation that you can't control remotely, it's only a matter of time before disaster strikes. The heat of summer can fry sensitive plants in a day or two. I'm not the only one who learned this the hard way. Once when we were away, I didn't know the irrigation wasn't working, and when we came home, everything looked dreadful. 5 years of work in the garden, gone, said New York designer Magdalena Keck, who has a 900-square-foot roof garden in Manhattan. Eventually, some plants like the wisteria did come back the next year, but I lost the fragile ones like basil and parsley. The cure? Upgrade with a smart sprinkler timer that allows you to monitor the performance of your irrigation system from your phone. If you're super paranoid, like I am now, you can set it up to send a message every time the garden gets water, Keck said. If you're out of town and it rains, you can also turn it off so you don't waste water. 6. Working overtime. Some gardeners, okay, me, make too much work for themselves and then get overwhelmed. When a gardener moves into a house on a half-acre lot and in the first year tries to single-handedly take care of sprawling beds of flowering perennials, climbing roses that need pruning, an espaliered pear tree, and a manicured lawn, okay, me again in my second Long Island yard, garden chores become drudgery. The cure? Swap in swaths of low-maintenance plants, such as native grasses planted en masse, or ferns to fill a shady corner, and replace finicky lawns with surfaces that never need mowing. Then don't add unless you think more work sounds like fun, or you can afford to hire help. I have a client with a large upstate garden who first installed a gravel patio with a few plants around it, Pulver said. It felt manageable, so she's adding a meadow, making it pretty much all native, so it will be less work. 7. Static cling. You can't expect a garden to stay the same year after year. Plants die, trees grow, sunny spots turn shady, winters get warmer. Ignoring that reality will take its toll on your garden. The cure? Don't mourn change or loss in the garden. Instead, every year at some point, take an inventory, what survived, what died, what got too big. Then replace, repair, and replant as necessary. No garden will look the same 5 years after you plant it, Hollander said. So try to enjoy the fact that the landscape will evolve naturally and help it along. An article by Michelle Slatala, published on March 29th and appeared in the March 30th, 2024 print edition of the Wall Street Journal as "The 7 Worst Blunders I Have Made in My Garden." We turn next from the workday world of gardening to the professionals with Robin Lane Fox's column of April 5th, An English Garden That Is a Tribute to Transient Beauty. Seize the moment and visit the RHS flagship Wisley in Surrey, where short-lived blossoms have been at their best. Spring flowers are fleeting, here one week, gone the next. The great classical poets used to compare the short-lived beauty of girls and boys to the transient beauty of flowers and berries. If you're young and beautiful, or if you have a young beauty in the household, this spring is good news for you. Spring beauties in the garden have persisted for an unusually long time, neither wilting in sudden heat nor browning in frost at midnight. Seizing the moment, I have been to see what the Royal Horticultural Society is making of it. Its central garden is at Wisley, Surrey, on a site whose soil and climate are not a gardener's godsend. The house at Wisley is no beauty, and the entry into the garden never did much for visiting gardeners' morale. What a change since 2019. Entry has been redesigned and given a regular pair of courtyards. Ornamental trees fit inside them, well-spaced in regular patterns of straight lines. They are one variety, a bold decision. When I visited, their haze of pinkish-white blossom was at its annual peak, a transient beauty, but my sight of the year so far. I was delighted, but surprised. The trees are Yoshino cherries, Prunus ex yedoensis, one that arose in Japan as a hybrid and was named botanically in 1902. Recent genetic studies have settled its contested origin. It arose in Japan as a hybrid between an Oshima cherry and a cherry called Edo Higan. Upon seeing Wisley's courtyard, I had associated this cherry with a wide sideways spread, the shape it assumes in my garden and also in the National Collection of Flowering Cherries in the Batsford Arboretum in Gloucestershire, to which I went 10 days later for a cherry check. Yoshino cherries sometimes weep downwards, too, as a result of grafting. In Japan, they are widely planted, and in 1912 were included in Japan's gift of cherry trees to Washington, D.C., where they are still spectacular. On Pilgrim Hill in New York's Central Park, they are a fine sight each spring, single-flowered and upright, inhabit like Wisley's trees. I now learn that there are several named varieties of Prunus ex yedoensis in Japan, accounting for the variation between Wisley's and those in other gardens, including mine. Wisley's trees are about 20 feet high, each showing single flowers with a slight flush of pink and a faint scent of almonds. In 2019, they were chosen with the approval of the courtyard's designer, Christopher Bradley Hole, and were planted as semi-mature specimens of varying height, some of which were sourced in Germany. They have flourished splendidly. Who cares if their flowers are short-lived? They are so beautiful that we are lucky to see them and need to try yearly to coincide with them. Swept on by their cloud of blossom, I wafted into Wisley's garden to see if anything else measured up to them. I can well believe that the garden's wisterias soon will. On a long avenue of metal arches, Wisley's wisterias are superbly trimmed and presented, mixing Floribunda Royal Purple with Kimono, free-flowering varieties, which have long, hanging clusters of pink and lilac-white flowers. In last year's late frost, Wisley's gardeners lit fires at night like vineyard owners in France or the orchard farmers in Chekhov's great short story, The Black Monk. The Wisley Gardeners, too, wanted to keep their treasured climbers from freezing and having a blank year. My personal favorite among Floribunda wisterias is the pure white alba, but Wisley's kimonos and royal purples will be a sight to behold in May. Since the early 1990s, I notice how many more of Wisley's flower beds have choice varieties of this or that, befitting gardening's self-styled headquarters. The hellebores include Dorothy's Dawn with pinkish flowers and marbled leaves. The weigelias include Middendorfiana Mango, whose cream-yellow flowers hang like bells and have red-orange throats, too seldom seen in other gardens. In big borders, I admired the dark purple-pink flowers of Magnolia Cachalander, a hybrid well worth sourcing. So is Camellia Japonica Grand Prix, in fine shape at Wisley, with masses of red flowers unbrowned by frost. On a visit to the RHS's Prime Garden, I want to see new varieties and extend my awareness. I also want to see excellent maintenance. It is in evidence in each section I saw. Wisley's site covers more than 200 acres and uses 84 gardeners, 30 students and apprentices, and another 140 volunteers who give a day a week. Even with such a workforce, it is easy to lose control and allow standards to slip. Under Matthew Pottage's direction, nothing has slipped in what I saw. I pass over the frightful garden sculptures, one of which shows yet another horse's outsized head in vertical profile, while another, a dire composition called Lovers on Horseback, cast in gray, shows humans with animal heads embracing on horseback. If only the horse could gallop, I would direct it to a pit out of sight. The garden does not need such distractions. In the 1960s, I used to read in the Society's monthly journal of this or that problem in Wisley's gardens, lightened only by news from its alpine house of mountain plants and bulbs under glass. There is still an alpine house, I found to my glee, and it is a tribute to transient beauty. The pots of bulbs and individual cushion plants are changed daily, about 15 moving in and out every week from supporting frames and houses. The superb blue flowers on Tecophyllea, the blue so-called crocus from Chile, were a sight of the day, matched by pots of cyclamen, many rare irises, and a superb pan of yellow-flowered Adonis cylanea, a wildflower from southern Greece, which will not persist outdoors in a British winter. Outside the alpine house, Wisley still has a fine rock wall, complete with ramondas grown vertically and pink-flowered Primula aelionii, which dies if planted horizontally in my garden. I floated down the hillside, not lonely as a cloud, but relishing the timing of my visit. The best was to come, spreading out before me. In the Society's old journals, I used to read of its meadow of hoop petticoat daffodils, the trumpet-free Narcissus bulbicodium, which grows about 6 inches high and is at its yellow best in the wild in Spain. I bought a few bulbs with my pocket money, but they dislike dry soil and only flowered once. At Wisley, they flower by the thousand, wild daffodils as Wordsworth never saw them, thriving in damp soil, in a routine which leaves them unmown until September. For more than 100 years, they have flourished in this prime position, their best in Britain, going back to the days of a formidable Edwardian gardener, Ellen Wilmot, who loved narcissi and probably planted the first hoop petticoats in the Society's early days of ownership at Wisley. Cherries, alpines, vertically grown primulas, yellow petticoat narcissi, their beauty soon comes and goes, but like the beauty of youth, it is a sight we need to treasure. At Wisley, these plants improve with care from year to year, what the Society's mission aims to show and encourage. A recent column by Robin Lane Fox, published in the Financial Times of London on April 5th, an English garden that is a tribute to transient beauty. Next article We stay with the Financial Times with an article by Hannah Gardner, published on the 31st of March in their garden section. Many of us have a little bit of mean roys in our gardens. A new book reveals the forward thinking of the late Dutch landscape designer, the mother of modernist gardens. The Dutch landscape architect, Mien Royce, created her first garden in 1923, aged 19. She went on to work on more than 3,000 projects in the Netherlands. She died in 1999, but her modernist creations are as relevant as ever, inspiring the work of many designers today. John Brooks, Charlotte Harris, Dan Pearson, and fellow Dutchman Piet Udolf cite her as an influence. However, until now, there has been little in-depth analysis of her portfolio available in English. A recent book by Julia Crawford, Mien Royce, The Mother of Modernist Gardens, published by Lund Humphreys, 39.95 pounds, opens the door on an illustrious career. The clean lines and natural planting style of her early experimental wilderness garden, designed nearly a century ago, looks strikingly up to date. Her geometric design, use of aggregate materials, and naturalistic planting are a combination still wildly popular. Royce grew up on one of the most prestigious Dutch perennial nurseries. Her father had established the Royal Muurheim Nursery, Dems de Vaart, in 1888. It was here that she developed her plantsmanship, rubbing shoulders with influential figures such as Gertrude Jekyll and Karl Forster, who popularized the use of ornamental grasses. Determined to follow her own interest in design and its social impact, she studied abroad in the 1920s in Tunbridge Wells, England, followed by a course combining contemporary architecture and landscape design in Berlin. Immersing herself in art movements such as De Stijl, Royce encouraged interdisciplinary collaboration, functional design, and access to green space for all citizens. Post-war, she was commissioned to create communal gardens in new social housing schemes, schools, factories, and hospitals. The dynamic connection between buildings and the landscape was a key element to her style, what she described in a 1992 book as an explicit architectural form softened by lavish planting, and she collaborated with architects including Gerrit Rietveld. However, it is the trial gardens by the nursery in De Demsvaart, called Tuinen Mien Royce, that lie at the heart of Crawford's book. Developed throughout her career, they offer a well-preserved overview of Royce's work. The atmospheric planting utilizes a bold, restricted color palette, geometric structure, and an appreciation of seasonality. Ahead of her time, Royce valued textural seed heads and the movement of tall grasses. Her naturalistic drifts of perennials are juxtaposed with boxy blocks of topiary. Whether it's a name we are aware of or not, many of us will have a little bit of mean in our gardens, writes Crawford. Interested in innovative twists and problem-solving, her choice of and reuse of materials was in large part a reaction to post-war restrictions on resources and funding. Later in her career, much like many designers today, Roy's choices were driven by environmental awareness. In her 1990 Marsh Garden featured a floating walkway made from recycled plastic. She was also known as the first designer to prominently feature repurposed railway sleepers. Sleeper Mien, Crawford writes, was one nickname, as was Diagonal Mien, a reference to her frequent and clever use of the oblique line. As Piet Udolf notes in his 1999 book Designing with Plants, she was everywhere, the only garden designer in Holland who was talking about plants and plantings. The others just talked about design. Tuinen Mien Royce will reopen to visitors from April 1, and for those wanting to emulate her distinctive approach, Garden Masterclass will hold a workshop there on June 27th. Royce continued her work into her 80s, as Annette Skolma, a former employee, recalls Royce saying toward the end of her life, "I'm sad it has come to an end. I'm far from finished." The website is tuinenmienroys.nl, and that's spelled TuinenMienroys.nl, and gardenmasterclass.org. An article by Hannah Gardner, published in the Financial Times of London on the 31st of March, many of us have a little bit of mean Royce in our gardens. We continue with our continental perspective with our next article written by Jane Owen, published on the 21st of March in the Financial Times, again in the garden section, from Spiders to the Sublime, Art Disrupts an Arcadian Landscape. Compton Verney, an English manor with a capability brown garden, hosts a range of works that fire the imagination. The garden visiting season launches at Easter, but a single-stop treasure chest of and inspiration for Arcadias big and small can be found at Compton Verney, the gallery in Capability Brown Design Park, 10 miles from Shakespeare's birthplace in the UK's Midlands. The gallery is celebrating its 20th anniversary with several new exhibitions packed with ideas from the sublime to the ridiculously lovely. Abby Viner, director of creative program, gave me a tour as works were being installed on a freezing afternoon before the exhibition opened. Inside the gallery, Landscape and Imagination from Gardens to Land Art, curated by Professor Christiana Payne, is an elegant, thoughtful tour of the place of landscape and gardens in our cultural memory. Using paintings, drawings, and sculpture, it speaks to Compton Verney's landscape, as well as gardens around the world, and Arcadian disruptors such as Ian Hamilton Finley, whose clever, teasing sculptures play and pun with ideas from classicism, fine art, and war. In one of his works, five stone finials morph from a globe through to a classic pineapple, and then a grenade. The last, a reminder of the late poet-artist landscape Little Sparta in Lanarkshire, where two pillars are topped with larger-than-life stone grenades. Another Hamilton Finley piece is his 1982 slate plaque, Woodland is Pleasing to the Muses, an idealized landscape with a military tank maneuvering through the trees. Gardens need jokes, dark or otherwise. They lift the soul when slugs have destroyed the heritage carrots. Those in search of more sober garden ideas should head to the mid-18th century picture showing the women's quarters of a Mughal palace with clipped trees shading a formal garden of square beds. A fountain plays at their center, while the women picnic in the foregrounds. Almost exactly contemporary is Canaletto's famous The Grand Walk, Vauxhall Gardens, circa 1751. Where more earthly pleasures were enjoyed by men and women in pavilions, tents, and promenades. Balthazar Nebut's 1738 painting of gardeners toiling over monumental hedging at Hartwell House, just outside London, is a reminder that well-executed garden structure is worth the effort. Likewise, displaced sketches and designs by Brown and his contemporaries illuminate the genius of a well-planned landscape garden. These are contrasted with the late Charles Jenks' visualization methods, which include plasticine models, anything and everything to get the picture right. Outside the main visitor entrance, sculpture comes into its own with Helen Chadwick's enameled white bronze piss flowers, created from the shapes made by the artist and her partner urinating into snow in the 1990s. It speaks to one of the several themes for the new Sculpture in the Park exhibition. At the back entrance to the house, London-based French artist Nicolas Deschaies' cast aluminum fountains appear over the subterranean remains of Compton Verney's formal water garden. His gut-like pieces, split, rummage, piss, and ejaculate, seeming to celebrate the fertility of aquatic and subterranean worlds, according to Compton Verney's description. Inside Compton Verney House, the Folk Art Gallery includes a hilarious picture called City Fowler's Mark, with a man and dog squatting. St. Paul's Cathedral in the distant background. And there's a further scatological flourish in the form of Augustus Serapinus, whose sinuous wooden fence, referencing Compton Verney's Anglo-Saxon and medieval history, is among the first sculptures visitors see as they come from the car park. The young Lithuanian artist gained notoriety by meeting curators and collectors in a sewer at the 2019 Venice Biennale. For those who prefer a less visceral approach to gardens, we move back inside. A picture of the late filmmaker Derek Jarman's Dungeness Garden by Jarman's friend, the celebrated photographer Howard Suley, provides a prescient echo alternative to English gardens. It is a gentle curation of plants, rocks, and found objects on the pebbly beach around Prospect Cottage, where the HIV-positive Jarman worked from the 1980s until his death in 1994. Nearby, a picture of Patricia Johansson's Fair Park Lagoon in Dallas shows her transformation of a dangerous swamp into an attractive lake in which her muscular, abstract, terracotta-colored gunite sculptures encourage wildlife and provide a local amenity. Even the kingfishers have returned. The wild gardening theme continues with Alexandra Daisy Ginsberg, who created the pollinator pathmaker planting in Kensington Gardens, London, in 2022. Her installation presents a flower garden from the perspective of bees and other pollinators, plus an interactive tool for creating insect-friendly plantings, whatever your garden soil and exposure. Compton Verney's landscape had its pollinator areas before the arrival of Ginsberg's work. Dan Pearson's William Morris Meadow was created in 2015, and there are two earlier wildflower meadows stretching to 80 acres and making gentle backdrops to the house as well as the new sculptures. Across the lake from the house, framed by cedars, laurels, and their dark vegetation, Brazilian artist Erica Verzuri's glittering, glowing, gold-colored Venus attempts to rectify the male-dominated, male-made landscape, while a 7-meter spider by Louise Bourgeois, the late reluctant hero of feminist art, stalks from Compton Verney's front door to the lake. Near Bourgeois' spider stands a full-size, 5-ton painted bronze Clydesdale horse and cart, Percival, looking as if it had just flown off an English pottery collector's mantelpiece and swallowed some of Alice in Wonderland's instantly enlarging Eat Me cake. This is a well-known work by Sarah Lucas, the smart, funny, provocative feminist artist. To reach Lucas's horse, and indeed the rest of the show, visitors have to cross a serpentine lake created when Brown dammed a local stream via the Brownian Bridge, guarded by two lead sphinxes. This is a journey Brown would have considered carefully in terms of impressing and pleasing visitors and landowners alike by framing views and placing the carriage drive route to show off the park and house. It appears so natural that it's hard to believe Brown created it without modern surveying equipment, let alone 3D CGI animation, to give an instant impression of how his designs would appear as the landscape and trees matured. Brown and the rest of the English landscape school gave such beauty to the world that I used to balk at any embellishment or additions. Some still jar, but the care and thought that has gone into Compton Verney's exhibition, with their site references and celebrations of what has gone before, as well as what might be the future, have begun to change my view. Brownian landscapes are sculpture in their own right, but an extra layer of interest doesn't entirely blot out Brown's Brio or William Kent's, or anybody else's, come to that. And the truth is that the English landscape school is a mishmash of ideas and influences borrowed and reinterpreted by many, including the French artist Claude Lorrain, whose work appears in Compton Verney House, working mostly in Italy and selling his idealized classical landscape paintings to the English on their grand tour. The tourists returned to the UK and made flesh what were, until then, largely imaginary landscapes. This small and privileged elite created them for their own delectation on the backs of poorly paid estate workers. For visitors who would not count Compton Verney as one of their Arcadias, for whatever reason, there are plenty of garden and landscape ideas here to fire the soul and the imagination this springtime. The gallery has been a wonderful collection of ideas and inspiration since its inception. The only puzzle is why it isn't better known. And in a sidebar article, how to create a wildflower meadow like Compton Verney's. Compton Verney's well-established meadows were planted using a mixture of seed and plug plants to produce a native perennial mix, rather than a showy annual wildflower meadow of cornflowers and poppies. Landscape manager Fiona Tansey, who maintains the 140 acres with the help of two others, explains. The native grasses have been most successful. Cattail, sweet vernal, smaller cattail, Yorkshire fog, she says, reeling off yet more irresistible names before moving on to some of the wildflowers that have taken here. Grass vetchling, a pea, rather than a grass with small pink flowers, red and white clover, lady's bedstraw, self-heal, meadow buttercup, bird's foot, trefoil. One key addition is yellow rattle. It parasites and so dwarfs invasive grasses, which might otherwise overwhelm more delicate specimens, and has done brilliantly, says Tansey, who points out another reason for the success of the wildflowers here. It's not a great soil. Five new exhibitions, including Sculpture in the Park and Landscape and Imagination from Gardens to Land Art, launched on March 21st. The sculptures will be in place for 3 years. Landscape and Imagination from Gardens to Land Art closes Sunday, June 16th. The website is one word, Compton Verney, CompTonVerney.org.uk. An article by Jane Owen, who is a Financial Times contributing editor and garden author, published in the Financial Times on the 21st of March. From spiders to the sublime, art disrupts an Arcadian landscape. That wraps up edition 241 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments at www.lars.org or email us at one word, laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think about the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plant, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us even as we try to create order and structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty and of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardeners, other gardens, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, or planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.